Okay. Welcome everyone to our weekly Sunday talk. I apologize for any of you who showed up last week. I had to go out of town. And I did let them know in advance, but I don't think any notices went out, so... Anyway, I'm here today, so welcome. Good to see people coming. So today I'd like to talk about how to make progress and how to find success in the meditation practice. I think that the how-to idea has great importance in Buddhism. It's a very good way to approach the Buddhist teaching, having how-to guides, how to do this, how to that. And so, of course, the first thing is how to meditate, how to practice, how to follow the Buddhist teaching. But another important how-to is how to meet with success in your practice, how to practice meditation in such a way that you actually come closer to the goal, when you actually progress and reach the goal. Because there's often the complaint that these teachings are all nice and good, but impossible to practice in daily life, or very difficult to practice, or hard to understand. I get this a lot. It sounds all fine and good, but I can't believe that such a thing is possible. So we need to explain what it is that makes your meditation practice fail, and how you can work to make sure that your practice succeeds. I suppose the biggest thing that causes meditation to fail is inadequate instruction. So you pick up a book, or you go and listen to a talk, or you even go to a meditation center and are given basic instruction on how to sit, how to practice meditation. But because you don't have one-on-one interaction with a teacher, or oftentimes teachers aren't adequately trained to be able to answer the types of questions and to fix the sorts of problems that come up. So you get people teaching very basic meditation and not able to go further. But more often than that, even is just lack of a teacher entirely. It's not that the teachers that exist are incompetent. It's that we're not able to find a teacher, and this can be quite discouraging. It makes you think that Buddhism is just a theoretical impossibility. This idea of attaining Nibbana or Nirvana, the idea of not having any greed or anger or delusion, the idea of enlightenment. And it's generally because For many people, we live in a location where there is no teacher, or else we don't feel ready or so interested in taking the effort, making the effort to go to a meditation center. So we pick up a book, or we listen to a talk, or we find some guide on meditation, and when we get stuck, we're not able to get the answers to all our questions. So we don't have the proper guidance, and it makes us afraid or uncertain, and so we quit. And I've heard this a lot, of people quitting because they got to a point where something came up and they didn't know how to deal with it. Another reason why meditation often fails, and this is something that occurs quite often, is that the meditation practice is out of whack with our daily life. Our way of life is not in line with the meditation practice. People who take drugs or alcohol can often be interested in the practice of meditation, and so will come to practice. There have even been stories of people going to meditation centers and bringing marijuana or other drugs, and sneaking off and getting high during the meditation course, thinking that somehow it's the same thing. Getting stoned and becoming enlightened have some connection somehow. Other things like people who have wrong livelihood or so on, or who are simply unprepared for the nature of the meditation. So people who think that meditation is kind of a relaxation, and who have no interest whatsoever in giving up their addictions and their attachments. People who are sort of trying meditation for fun, and will go to do a meditation course thinking of it kind of as a vacation, and when they go back to their lives, they have no intention of changing their lives. They have no intention of making their lives more meditative. Or though they might have that sort of intention, they don't realize what it entails, that it entails giving up much of our ambition and much of our pursuit and much of our addiction, much of our busyness. So we go back unprepared to change. And that's really a problem, because, of course, enlightenment is a great change. We're not trying to come here to add something on to who we are. We're coming here to change things about who we are. If you're not interested in changing yourself, then there's not much that the meditation practice can do for you, except gives you high states of concentration, which are in addition to your ordinary state of existence. And so for many people, that's all meditation is. It's a way, it's a break, it's a relief. You come meditate, you get highly focused, maybe see some strange things, maybe experience some funny things, and come back to your daily life, it wears off, and you go back to who you were. This is, of course, not what we mean by meditation, and it's certainly not the way to become enlightened. So how do we succeed? How do we actually bring the meditation into our lives? And say you're a person who's new to Buddhism and new to meditation, and you want to start meditating. What can you do to actually succeed in incorporating it into your life? Well, there are steps that we can follow. And the first thing to note is that we really have to be in it for the long haul. We have to think of meditation as a part of our lives. When we approach the practice of meditation, it's not a break, it's not a vacation, it's not a temporary thing. It's a skill that we're hoping to acquire and bring into our ordinary lives, bring into our lives and become a part of who we are. This is the attitude we should approach it with. It doesn't mean we have to at the point where we're ready to change everything. In the beginning, we just have to understand that it's going to be a long-term thing. You can't expect to go to a meditation center for 10 days and become enlightened. You shouldn't expect to gain much from 10 days. It's a wonderful thing to do, and it's a very important part, as I'll explain. But the biggest problem that comes from doing meditation courses is the high expectations that come along with it. We expect that after a meditation course we should be enlightened. We should have attained some high state of realization. And I would say that when you do a meditation course, there are states of realization that are gained. It's just they're generally not on the level that we assume them to be, that we would expect them to be. And so you get people leaving from a meditation course all full of themselves, thinking they're enlightened already. And they go home and they start to teach other people, and they start to act as though they're fully enlightened, and everything they say is right. And when people don't agree with them, they get angry and realize that they're not enlightened, feel all depressed and think they gained nothing out of the practice, and it was a fake and a sham and so on. And often give up meditation as a result. Not often, but can give up meditation. At the very least, they feel discouraged and confused and go through quite a bit of unnecessary suffering because of their high expectations. So it's going to be a long haul. It's a skill that we're going to gain. It's a training. What we're learning in a meditation course is a path of training. The 10 days or the 15 days or the 1 month or so on is not the be-all, end-all of our... It's not the end of our lives. It's not like we go in the meditation center, come out, and we're perfect. What we're gaining is a means to then continue our life in a way so that we're always developing ourselves towards the ultimate goal. So the first thing you need to succeed in meditation is a demonstration. Someone has to show you how to meditate. I think in many cases, this can supplant any sort of theoretical knowledge and understanding. With a qualified demonstrator or demonstration, you don't really need to understand all of these high and mighty Buddhist concepts. All you need is someone to show you what we're doing and explain why we're doing it, explain what everything means. So for instance, I know many places that teach the same sort of practice that I teach. In Thailand, for example, many, many monasteries, I'd say probably a majority of monasteries in Thailand are capable of teaching basic meditation practice, but they're generally not capable of explaining why we're meditating and why we're doing these odd things that we do in meditation. For instance, you sit and we tell you how to watch the stomach. When the breath comes into the body, the stomach will rise. When the breath goes out of the body, the stomach will fall. And what we have you do is when the stomach rises, we have you say to yourself, rising. When it falls, we have you say, falling. Rising, falling. And that's a basic meditation practice. What the problem is, even today, a woman came to see me, and I had a bit of difficulty explaining to her because she wasn't really interested in hearing what I had to say. She's a Thai woman, and she practices watching her breath, and she wasn't interested. She even said she had tried this practice, and she'd gone even for a week to do this practice, but didn't really understand why. What's the point, and what's the benefit? It seems kind of mundane that we're watching something that is quite unrelated to our state of mind and our state of our way of life. Watching our stomach seems like a very pointless exercise. So the proper instruction, the demonstration of how to practice, should include an explanation of why we practice. And this is one of the difficulties that we find, that there's generally not this level of explanation. Why we do the rising and falling, or any meditation technique for that matter, is as a means of training our mind in a certain task, or in developing a certain ability in our mind. We're not interested in the stomach per se. There's nothing special about this rising and falling movement, except that it's the only movement that occurs in a relaxed body. When you first start meditating, it in fact might not be clear at all. You'll find yourself breathing from the chest, or you'll find that when you breathe in, your stomach actually falls, or goes inward. When you breathe out, your stomach expands. And this was the case of the woman today, and I had to have her lie down on her back before she was able to see that indeed, in a natural state, the rising of the stomach is accompanied with the in-breath. When we breathe in, our stomach should expand, and you can test this by lying on your back. So the reason we use it is because it should be the only movement of the body. The point is, we're trying to look at reality. We're trying to teach our mind that when something arises, it should be seen as it is. When the stomach rises, we should see it as rising. When anything arises, we should see it just for what it is. Because this is going to be the fundamental talent that we're trying to gain, the fundamental ability that we're trying to train in ourselves, this ability to see things as they are. When someone yells at you, to see it for what it is, it's a sound touching your ear, you know, there's things going on in their mind, and to not turn it into an issue where you've got this person and I am being attacked, and this attachment to self and so on. To be able to break reality up into its component parts and see it for what it is. When you feel pain in the body, to be able to see it just for pain and not get upset or attached to it. So we're using the rising and the falling in this case as a means of training this talent, this ability to see things for what they are. The other thing is that it doesn't really matter what you use to meditate. In the beginning, you're going to see a big difference between, say, watching the rising and the falling and watching your emotions. When you watch your emotions, you can see an immediate result that you find yourself letting go of your anger, letting go of your greed. When you watch the pain in the body, you'll be able to see yourself letting go. And so the rising and falling seems like a rather useless object. But the other interesting thing is this idea that everything is the same, that all objects are equal. And you can gain wisdom by watching absolutely anything as long as that object is real. And this is very clearly observable in the rising and falling. This is to the extent that it's amazing the benefits that you can gain from such a mundane activity. You can become enlightened watching your stomach. And I guarantee that anyone who tries this will be able to verify it. The problem is, when you start to verify it, it seems like you're doing something wrong. I'll explain. What we're trying to realize in Buddhism on the path is we're trying to see the three characteristics of existence. We're trying to see that everything in the world, nothing in the world is worth clinging to. We're trying to get this through our heads that there's nothing worth clinging to. Clinging to any specific thing in the world is not of any benefit to us. We're trying to see the true nature of everything that arises, that there's nothing good or bad about anything. And so to be able to experience all of reality for what it is, to live a natural, a balanced, and a free life. The three characteristics that we're going to see are impermanence, suffering, and non-self. And these exist in absolutely everything inside of us and the world around us. And this is what makes it, like it or not, makes it the truth that nothing in the world is worth clinging to. first of all, impermanence. When you watch, say, the rising and the falling, you'll see it changing. You'll see in the beginning it can be quite easy. Rising, falling, and then suddenly it changes. Suddenly the rising gets stuck, or the belly gets stiff or uncomfortable. Maybe suddenly it disappears. Suddenly it's no longer rising and falling. You can't find it. And then it comes back, and then it goes. And this can be quite frustrating, because we expect things to be stable. We expect things to be constant. If it's not constant, we don't want to have anything to do with it. So we're always on the search for finding something that is stable, finding stability, finding something, a way of life that is going to let us be that way forever. And this is why these theistic religions are so appealing, the idea that you can have eternal life. In fact, a funny story is I had the Mormons come and visit me yesterday, and they were trying to make a pitch for the kingdom, the celestial kingdom of God. And I said, well, what's the difference between these different kingdoms? And they said, well, in this third kingdom, you get to be with your family for the rest of eternity. And I thought, oh dear, that's not really a very good selling point. Not for many of us anyway. This is the kind of thing that, you know, they've been indoctrinated, and it really, you know, appeals if you think about it, and if you're indoctrinated from an early age, you know, you would tend to develop love and harmony with your family, and as a result, you know, it would really appeal to people to be able to have this stability. The problem is, it's not the truth. There's no stability. There's no permanence to be found in the universe. The second one is suffering, and the word suffering here, sort of the cornerstone of Buddhism, and this one that everyone's always afraid of. Teachers are afraid to teach it. Newcomers to Buddhism are afraid to hear it, and it leads people away from Buddhism. It leads opponents to Buddhism to, you know, make all sorts of crazy accusations. The meaning of suffering is that everything in the world is unsatisfying, is suffering. The suffering comes from clinging to it. Because when you cling to something that's unstable, you suffer when it's gone. This is why we don't like things like watching our stomach. This is why when you start to do it, it seems like you're doing something wrong. Or it seems like this meditation is not a good meditation, because you practice it and, you know, it makes you suffer. It seems like watching the rising and the falling is unpleasant. Why is it unpleasant? Because you're trying to keep it permanent. You're trying to force your breath. It's the case with everybody when you start doing it. The truth is, we try to force everything in our lives. We can't just experience things. We react immediately. Oh no, this is no good. It has to be like this. Or, oh yes, this is good. Stay like that. We're always trying to force things to be the way we expect them. And because of our limited intelligence and wisdom, that's generally quite far out of touch with the way things really are. The way we expect things to be is not in tune with reality. So as a result, when we don't, when the rising, you know, rising, falling, and then it changes, or you know, it's not deep enough, or it's not coming at the time that we want it to. We're watching it, hasn't come yet. We make it rise, or so on, or we expect it to be smooth, and we immediately try to find this rhythm where it would be totally comfortable all the time, right? Just like music, you'd have this rhythm of your breath, which would be totally comfortable and peaceful, and we want that. The problem is, reality is not like that. If you want that, you have to turn on the stereo and turn on something fake, something created, because reality doesn't work that way. So as a result, we suffer. You know, just watching just a simple thing like watching the rising and falling makes people suffer, because they're not able to keep up with the rhythm of life. They're not in tune with the rhythm of nature, the rhythm of the reality in front of them, which is a totally inconstant rhythm. It's changing all the time. It's a lot more like jazz than bebop. So for this reason, you know, it's very easy for people to fail even when they've started to practice correctly. They think something's wrong. And I get this question a lot. This is the role of a teacher. So the second thing that you need, besides a good explanation, is a good teacher, someone who's able to explain these things to you. You have to, once you've been explained how to practice, shown how to practice, and explained why we're practicing, so that when you do it, you understand why you're doing it, and you know in which direction to extend your mind. You're not trying to force things, you're just trying to watch it. What you should be gaining is just a sense that this is the rising, this is the falling. And you should look at it as a training, not expecting anything else to appear, where sort of rising, falling, and suddenly you start to see angels or start to see heaven or so on. You should be thinking that you're doing this to train your mind, so that then when anything else arises, you're able to see it clearly as well. Then the next thing you need is an instructor, someone to lead you through the practice and explain what you are seeing, and to point out to you that what you're seeing, there's nothing wrong with what you're seeing. There can't be anything wrong with what you're seeing. What you're seeing is the nature of that object. We mistakenly assume that we're doing something wrong, or there's something wrong with this type of practice. Where if we, you know, analyze it logically and rationally, we're actually not doing anything except watching it and reminding ourselves it is what it is, saying to ourselves, this is rising, this is falling, recognizing it for what it is. Like when you see a friend and you're like, oh, that's this person, that's that person. The problem is our minds go so much further, and our minds expect things to be in a different way. So the job of the teacher is to remind you of these things, remind you, you know, that actually what you're seeing is reality. The problem is not the objects. The problem is your expectations. You think it should be other than that, and so you suffer. Even pain that arises. Sometimes when you say to yourself, pain, 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 just reminding yourself, recognizing it as pain, sometimes the pain gets worse. And this is where people really start to freak out or you know, become sure in their mind that there's something wrong with this practice, because you know, the idea, though it's generally, you know, it's pretty clearly stated that this isn't the intention, the idea that people have in their minds is the acknowledgement somehow gets rid of all your suffering, somehow removes the pain. So you say to yourself, pain, 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 and poof, the pain is gone. And that's not at all the point. The point of saying to yourself, pain, 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 is to teach your mind the correct way of responding to the object, instead of bad, 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 or what am I going to do about this, and you know, going on and on in your mind about what's wrong with this terrible pain. You're just saying to yourself, pain, pain. You're just knowing it for what it is. When you see the pain, you say, oh, this is pain. And you remind yourself again and again to stop yourself from turning something, one thing, into many things that it's not. What it is pain, and that's really all it is. The idea that it's I, me, mine, good, bad, is totally external to the reality. The next thing you need to do is to set up a schedule for your practice. And scheduled practice comes in many forms, and it's worth discussing these different forms. The best type of scheduled practice, I would say, is the retreat. It is the intensive meditation course. And the problem, as I said, is that we often are people who are keen on doing retreats tend to segregate their existence into two modes, the retreat mode and the daily life mode, and are not interested or willing to bring these two together. And so there's a difficulty here, because the retreat is a very intensive way of life, and the problem generally is if you're coming from a life where you're not meditating, where your mind is not ready to accept this intensity of practice, you wind up suppressing most of your defilements. And so the results that you get from a short course can be profound on a certain level, but are never going to likely get at the deep defilements, because most of them are simply suppressed. In Buddhism, there are many levels of defilement. There are the coarse defilements, the refined ones, and the very subtle and hard to understand or hard to realize, hard to see defilements. And in order to get rid of the coarse ones, you have to cover up so many more of them. In the practice, we aren't able to deal with or come to terms with all of the problems that exist in our minds. So we wind up crushing simply through our tendency or our habit to do so, most of the defilements. We aren't able to see the intricacies of our mind. And that's the only way we could survive in such an intense meditation practice. So short retreats tend to bring about a strong amount of concentration and are only able to cut off a certain level of the defilements. But I still think it's the best way. It's just that you have to, you shouldn't see it as 10 days and then back to life as normal. You should think, okay, this is a way of helping me to change my life. This is going to give me some tools, some understanding. It's going to lift me up for sure, but it's also going to be an example, the purest example of how I could possibly live my life. For most of us, it's not possible to get into that state of constantly meditating, constantly doing a formal meditation practice. Most people have jobs or commitments of various sorts, and so the best they can do is to take a vacation and go off and do a retreat. So that's great, because you're certainly going to get some level of attainment, but the important lesson that we have to bring from the meditation is that we have to transform our lives, that this indeed is the highest state, the state of pure contemplation of reality for what it is. These contrived states of being a professional, having a career, being a mother or a father, all of the contrived state of even being human, these are all limited and superficial, ephemeral, and not connected with true and lasting peace and happiness. So what you tend to see for those people who are successful in meditation, that they tend to drastically alter their way of life. Even if they're living in the world, they might give up a good job to in favor of a part-time or a job that frees them from the burden of responsibility that they had before. And this is what you'll see. I'm not making this up. If you've talked to meditators, you'll see them changing their lives. And you can ask them how they've changed their lives. You'll find them living much for the moment, not worrying about things like pension or retirement or so on, but rather trying to take as much time as they can to meditate, because they get this understanding that in the end we all have to die, and really all that's real is our experience of sensual reality, no matter what position we're in. So they're not really concerned about stability or, you know, this false sort of stability and security that ordinary people are keen on. And eventually they find themselves gravitating more and more towards the monastic life or the meditative life. Sometimes they'll go and work at meditation centers, volunteer at monasteries, even to the point where they'll become male and female monastics. And so this is the one side of things, this monastic type of meditation retreat, which is really the most pure and refined sort of practice. But how do we make it, how do we begin this process of bringing the meditation into our life? I'd like to encourage everyone to take the time, to find the time to take a vacation, find a meditation center. There are lots of them, and you can, generally we can find a way to sacrifice certain things in order to take the time to do a meditation course somewhere. If not in your country, then maybe in a nearby country, or even going to Asia, for instance. Whether you're able to do that or not, there are ways that you should be incorporating the meditation into your daily life. The way of bringing the two together, your daily life and the retreat experience, is to begin to practice in daily life. And the easiest way to do this, and the way that most successful meditators do, is to do a daily meditation practice, to set time aside in their schedule. And I would submit that it's easier than it sounds, and it's generally easier than people make it out to be. We think that we're so busy that we couldn't possibly have time for meditation. We think that our minds are so stressed out we couldn't possibly do a proper meditation. And the first one, the idea that we don't have enough time, is a myth. I would say, for most people, an excuse, and it's the result of not looking close enough at our lives. If you've got enough time to spend a half hour on Facebook, then you've got enough time to meditate. I would say many people spend far more time than that on Facebook. And all you need to do is find 5 minutes a day and you can start meditating. If you can find 5 minutes out of, 1440? Is that how many minutes there are in a day? 24 times 60? Is that right? Yeah, 1440. 1,440 minutes in a day. All you need are five. That's like one in, I don't know how many, one in 20? One in 30? Almost one in 30. 1/30th of your life you spend in meditation. That's how you start. People always ask me, how many minutes a day should you practice? And the answer is more than zero. If you're practicing 0 minutes a day, then it's not enough. If you're practicing more than that, then you're on the path. You're starting. And it starts in this way. I guarantee that everyone, almost everyone in the world, can find 30 minutes a day to meditate. And just by starting with 5 minutes, 10 minutes a day, you can really, truly change your life. You can begin on a path of bringing these two together, bringing together the life of a meditator and the life of an ordinary person, to the point where you're living your life meditatively. You're living your life mindfully. So the next step, after you've done a course, or even if you haven't had the chance to do a course, is to find a way to start practicing in your life. Begin to do a daily meditation practice. The best thing to do is do twice a day. Once when you wake up in the morning before you start your day, and once before you go to sleep or sometime in the evening. Once you start to do that, if you can do twice a day, then you start to incorporate it into your daily life. You take a break during your work or lunch hour or so on and do 5 minutes, 10 minutes of meditation. And you slowly increase this. If you can do some days 20 minutes and then eventually 30 minutes when you start to get good at it, then you'll find that you really are making a dent in things. You really are working out a lot of the problems that you have in your life, that you're able to you're able to sort out the confusion and the mess that is our minds, and file away a lot of the errant thoughts and make sense of your life in a way that wasn't possible before. The other important part of bringing meditation into your daily life is, as I've explained before, actually meditating in your daily life. meditation isn't something that you have to do just on the sitting mat. You don't have to expect that the only time you can meditate is when you're sitting down on a mat with your eyes closed. The word meditation means to consider, right? Or to examine, to somehow be aware of what's going on or of a certain issue, to ponder. So here we're pondering reality, and reality is all around us at all times. It's even here in Second Life. They call this virtual reality in the sense that it's not real, but there is reality here. There's a reality in the chair that you're sitting on. There's a reality in the light that's coming off of your screen, the sound that's coming out of the speakers. There's a reality that's going on in your mind that's creating all of these people. You look at these pixels and you see a person. You look at those pixels and you see a frog. You look at those pixels and you see somebody with black wings, and so on and so on. You create all of this in your mind. There's a reality going on in your mind. You like this. This looks attractive. This looks repulsive. This makes me think of that. That makes me think of this, and so on. And this is the reality that goes on through our minds and our bodies and our world throughout our daily lives. You talk to someone, they make you angry. You talk to someone, they make you happy. All of these things arise and appear to us in our daily lives. Our work is simply to see things as they are, is to remind ourselves it's only that, it's only this, it is what it is, to prevent ourselves from overanalyzing and judging and making more of things than they actually are. So we go in this sort of progression. The best way to start is to find a teacher, find a center, whatever you can do, bug people, find someone who's going to help you, and don't be shy. Don't be afraid. If you don't like it, you can always quit. You can always find a new teacher. Buddhism is not, we're not trying to convert people or, take people as me, as my students, and so on. We're just trying to help others. So find someone who is willing to help you, lead you through the basics, and then start to develop in this way to the point where you're practicing once, twice a day, and actually incorporating it into your daily life. When you get angry, saying to yourself, angry, angry. When you feel pain and you feel sick or so on, saying to yourself, pain, pain, or aching, aching. When you feel depressed, depressed, depressed. When you feel stressed, stressed, stressed. Reminding yourself of things as they are, for what they are. And slowly changing the way you look at things until your mind starts to get it. When your mind starts to get the point that it is what it is. Reality, everything that arises simply is. Clinging is not a part of peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. Then you're on the path to enlightenment. And this act of getting it is what releases the mind, which frees the mind from clinging, from our attachment to samsara, and leads us to become enlightened. So that, I think, is anyway my take on what it takes to succeed in meditation. I'd like to thank everyone for coming today. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I wish you all the best and hope that you're all able to find peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering.